Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, former head of the state GOP Michael Whatley and Donald Trump daughter-in-law Laura Trump take control of the RNC with big changes for the party and for the upcoming election. Two North Carolina congressmen, Democrat Jeff Jackson and Republican Dan Bishop, both running for attorney general, take opposing sides on attempts by Congress to force the sale of TikTok. Mark Walker ends his campaign for Congress prior to a runoff, choosing instead to work for Donald Trump. State court judges block a law that would have shifted elected official appointments from the governor to the legislature. Our state's new Parents' Bill of Rights impacts an unexpected area of education. That and a ton of other education news. Plus, an update on the future of the Wells Fargo tournament will take us through the hour. And here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE's education reporter, Ann Doss Helms. Good morning to you. Mary C. Curtis is with us. She's a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Eric Spanberg is here. He's the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. You're here again. Like a bad penny.
Penny is back.
That's right.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And we're joined for the first time by morning anchor and host of Flashpoint on WCNC-TV, Ben Thompson. I know you get up really early in the morning, Ben, so try to stay awake. But I'm also curious as what took you so long to get here.
I know. Finally, it's taken about 18 years, but finally, I know I have made the big time.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the program. This week, appropriately the first week of daylight saving time, Congress has been debating the future of TikTok. It's kind of a clock thing, you know. In a rare agreement, most Republicans and Democrats want to ban it or force its sale by a Chinese-owned company, ByteDance, to an American one. What makes this a local story is the fact that two of our congressmen, both from both sides of the aisle, and both running for Secretary of State, are on opposite sides of this issue. Jeff Jackson is a prolific TikTok user, and he used that platform to explain to his constituents what might happen as a result of the bill in Congress and why he is pessimistic about a potential ban.
I don't think TikTok is going to be banned. There was a bill to ban TikTok last year, but it didn't pass. It didn't even get a vote. TikTok may be sold to another company, but it'll continue to operate. The bill that just passed the House was about telling TikTok they have to sell to another company. It hasn't passed the Senate, and I don't know if it will.
I misspoke. They're not running for Secretary of State. They're running for Attorney General, excuse me. But despite Jeff Jackson's use of the app, he joined the majority in the House in voting to force TikTok's owner, ByteDance, to sell it. Meanwhile, Republican Dan Bishop voted against the bill. Why?
It's a First Amendment issue for Congressman Bishop. So that's why we have this odd juxtaposition of these two candidates for Attorney General, because you're right, Mike. You look at this on the surface and your head starts to spin. When you hear the explanations, it is a little more in line with the way they generally view things. And I think, you know, your reference to the local implication, we're all looking forward to this race for Attorney General. This is going to be a slugfest.
Mary.
I think it's fascinating that on what issue would you have Dan Bishop and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez voting the same way? but you do hear. And it's interesting because Dan Bishop has always said he doesn't like the social media. He doesn't really care for it. He doesn't use it. But it's First Amendment. On the other hand, Jeff Jackson has 2.5 million followers. He's become known for explaining things on social media, on TikTok. And what I think is fascinating is that he explained his vote on social media, including TikTok.
And I thought it was one of the better explanations I saw. And granted, I didn't dive into this like I would if I was covering it, but his explanation about how this ad that popped up to tell people to lobby against this was like, oh, I get what that problem is now.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Ben, go ahead.
No, I just think it's interesting that you have this social media darling, more so than really any other politician in the United States, taking the stand, and now, in the days after that, getting serious blowback from those same people on social media because they're thinking, hey, you're supposed to be one of us. And now they're suggesting he's being hypocritical by taking the stand. Of course, he would say otherwise. But the reaction to this online has been just as fascinating.
Of course, in his social media post on TikTok, he went into great explanation of what this Chinese company allegedly does with the data. All of these companies collect data. If you're on Facebook, if you're on Instagram, they're collecting data on you. But the worry here is that the Chinese will use it against the country in some way. And also the algorithms spread mis- and disinformation. And he gave an example of that happening, which one of you just brought up. It happened this week when TikTok itself, he says, had a pop-up ad that spread mis- and disinformation.
A huge pop-up notification validated everyone's concerns. It didn't mention anything about the actual intent of the bill, which is to force a sale and allow TikTok to continue operating. It just mischaracterized the bill and then told everyone to take political action based on that mischaracterization. I'm amazed someone thought this was a good idea, but it proved the concern isn't hypothetical, it's real. They will misinform people on a huge scale and then use that to manipulate political behavior.
And this really is creating strange bedfellows in Washington. I mean, you mentioned, I think, Mary Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being on the same side of this issue as Dan Bishop, Pramila Jayapal, Ilhan Omar. They're all on the same side, along with Jim Clyburn from South Carolina and Nancy Mace. They're on the same side of this. Explain this to me. How did this happen? Nobody's on the same side of these issues anymore.
Well, it's a combination of many things. It's not just the First Amendment piece, but you have to put it in the broader context of the fact that this is hugely used. A lot of people have businesses based on it. Politically, you saw a lot of people come out and say, wait a minute, you are going to pay at the ballot box in a year when Democrats want to make sure they keep young people energized to vote for the Democratic ticket. So, yes, it is a very complicated issue, not just First Amendment issues, but hard-boiled electoral political issues.
Eric.
It's also interesting, just I would say in the last couple of years, the groundswell that is somewhat bipartisan on the dangers of tech, you know, because there is that part of the law that basically says they're not content providers, and that has caused such a kerfuffle in all of these debates about misinformation, disinformation. And so I think there is at least a healthy amount of consensus in both parties that social media in some ways has gone too far and needs more guardrails. I don't know that there's consensus on exactly how to fix it, but there is consensus that there's a problem.
Well, the fix would be to sell it to an American company.
Well, I just meant overall.
But there's a question about whether an American company could do anything with it, because the algorithms that operate the darn thing behind the scenes belong to this Chinese company. You'd have to reinvent the algorithms. This is going to face an uphill climb in the Senate, but Jeff Jackson hopes that they will side with him, because he said doing nothing would be an invitation for China to continue to spread misinformation. Forcing a sale, he said, would keep the app alive, which is something he supports because he uses it.
I do use it, and I think we can solve this problem and keep marching on. And the way we're going to solve it is the same way we solved it last time, because we've confronted this issue before. So that's the latest, and I'll keep you posted.
There you go.
Did I see a TikTok weather balloon outside?
I think you did, yeah. And he also tweeted that this bill is only the beginning of what we should be doing to reduce the harm of social media and to protect our kids online. We need new data privacy laws that will cover all social media platforms. If this bill passes the Senate, might this be the beginning of a movement in that direction? Because the European Union has already started doing this.
Well, President Biden has indicated that he would sign the bill if it gets to his desk. Now, as you mentioned, it has to go through the Senate. But as Eric referenced, this really addresses the China aspect of social media, which is an important one. But you still have a lot of young people out there who are suffering from being on social media too much, with Facebook and Instagram, Snapchat, all the other things. So this really does nothing about the larger issue about how addicted Americans are to the various social media platforms and sort of the results, both short-term and long-term, about it on our mental health.
And to follow up a little bit on what Ben was saying, we've already seen a lot of these social media leaders and heads come before Congress with young people and parents testifying how, you know, it has harmed their kids, how they have a very distorted view of themselves. As Ben said, this is just the beginning.
Well, Ben, since you're here, I'm glad you're here because you have the next story almost all to yourself. North Carolina Super Tuesday resulted in a couple of runoff elections being scheduled, and Mark Walker found himself in a runoff to regain his 6th district seat in Congress, which he left after redistricting in 2021. That runoff was going to be between him and Republican Addison McDowell, but this week, Walker dropped out of that race, meaning McDowell has won the contest. He's going to Washington. So, Ben, you spoke with Mark Walker for Sunday's Flashpoint on WCNC-TV. Why did he drop out?
That's right. This is the interesting thing. I mean, they were both under the 30% threshold. They were in two points of each other. Mark Walker's run on and off for different offices for years now. I was intrigued. Why quit now? After all, on Tuesday, he tweeted, "Hey, I want to debate Addison McDowell. Let's do it. It's the right thing for people." I found out once I talked to him, a short time after he tweeted that, he got a phone call from Donald Trump. And we know it lasted for about 15 minutes. And by the end of that 15-minute phone call, Walker dropped out of the race. And we know that he was offered by Mr. Trump, a director of faith outreach here in North Carolina. And I guess it was an offer that was too good to pass up for Mark Walker.
An offer he couldn't refuse. An adequate description there.
Donald Trump is my boss, you're saying, huh, Ben?
When Donald Trump was in the White House, Trump previously gave an endorsement to Mark Walker.
I was in the Oval Office. I remember Vice President Pence was to my left. Mick Mulvaney at the time was to my right. And we were talking in general terms. And I said, anything that I run for, he said, "Mark, anything that you run for, you'll have my support." 18 months passed. We didn't stay in contact a great deal. things change. People are able to present different cases.
So when Walker ran for the Senate, though, Trump threw his support to Ted Budd. And, of course, Ted Budd won that race. That had to have stung. But Mark Walker is about to go to work for Trump. Why would he trust Donald Trump at this point, Ben?
Yeah, he said in that 15-minute phone call on Wednesday that he expressed some of his frustrations about that. And you can tell, speaking to Mark Walker, that he's still sort of annoyed by that. He wanted to run for Senate and then thought he had the president's endorsement at the time and did not. And then, as we know, would then go on to run for governor and then got out of that race and then run for House. And in that same phone call, Donald Trump evidently said to him, "Hey, I didn't even realize that you were running until about a month ago." Well, that's a slap in the face as well. So you truly get the sense, talking to Mark Walker, that there's a, he won't say this, but there's a conflicted relationship there.
Yeah, well, I'm going to come back to that. Eric, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, it is amazing, Mike. We've talked about this again and again, how even by political standards, it is such outsized disparagement and mistreatment, or at minimum dismissal, that Trump gets away with. And yet these people come back and are allies. Tim Scott is another example. You could go on and on and on with the scroll. And this is just another addition to that list.
We're going to talk about this more when we talk about the RNC, but this is just further solidification that Donald Trump and the Republican Party, they are one. He does run it as a person. And as Eric said, add Walker to the long list of people that he has disrespected, who still feel so afraid of the base that they do come back to Trump. They do what he says. It hasn't been broken as yet. We'll see.
Psychologists are going to have a field day with this in 25 years or so. I'd like to be around for it, but unfortunately, I have other commitments to keep. We have to take a break. We're coming right back with Ann Doss-Helms, Ben Thompson, Mary C. Curtis, and Eric Spanberg at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business, to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Ann Doss-Helms is here from WFAE News. Ben Thompson from WCNC-TV, host of Flashpoint. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and a host of Equal Time, their podcast. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Before we move on, Ben, you talked to Mark Walker, who dropped out of the race for the sixth congressional district to take a job with Donald Trump here in North Carolina. You talked to him. It'll be on Flashpoint this Sunday, that conversation in its entirety. But you said that he had this 15-minute phone call with Donald Trump that changed the course of this race. And he described that phone call as compassionate. What does that mean?
He said compassionate, and then immediately after, he's like, I realize that probably sounds paradoxical for people listening to this. But I think, you know, Mark Walker, we're talking about Pat McCrory later, perhaps, interchange some of these names. I think some of these Republicans, like a Mark Walker, has spent the last few years trying to find his place in the Republican Party, whether it's a member of the House or whether it's in the Senate or whether it's a governor or what it is. And he might have just decided after this 15-minute phone call, I guess this is where I'm going to be in the Republican Party.
Well, he says he's a former pastor, by the way, for those who don't know Mark Walker, and he's going to work for Donald Trump on faith and minority outreach in North Carolina.
Based on, I guess, our skill set and what we were able to accomplish. Look, we were the first freshman ever to win the chairman for the largest caucus. We went on there. We're the highest rated conservative, serve in the top four or five leadership positions in the U.S. House. The only Republican in the country that's won the United Negro College President's Award, as well as giving the commencement address at one of our state's HBCUs. These kinds of compilations, I think, in talking with President Trump, was something that he wanted to move on pretty quickly to make sure that we have people that are in these different arenas that can talk about the value of these conservative principles.
So if he wins, if Trump wins, has he been promised a job at the White House?
It certainly sounds like it. I asked him that directly, and he says, I don't want to get into specifics, but it certainly indicated from our conversation that he's been promised something. I don't know if it's a specific job or position, but yeah, he even indicated that the president had said that not only in the phone call, but also in what the president put on social media as well.
So many of these people are depending on Trump getting in the White House, and it's fascinating. You say faith and minority outreach. Of course, the most loyal Trump base are white evangelicals, and they have been tantalized by these polls saying that particularly among a Latino working class, Black men, that Trump is going to get this huge amount of minority vote. And so you've seen this push for minority outreach. They say this all the time, and generally it doesn't exactly pan out, but it's interesting because the candidate himself is working against it a little bit when he says such stuff like Black people like me because, you know, they relate to the fact that I've been unjustly persecuted in the criminal justice system. But we shall see.
And it can also be argued successfully, I think, that Donald Trump is not a conservative. The leadership of the Republican National Committee changed this week. Donald Trump installed the former head of the North Carolina GOP, Michael Whatley, to co-chair the RNC with his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump. It didn't take long for them to start making changes, Mary. They fired a lot of people, and they're allowing some of those people to reapply for their jobs. Is that normal?
Well, I mean, it's normal in the party of Trump. The RNC is Trump. He has Michael Whatley, of course, from North Carolina GOP, also a huge election denier. He really bought into the 2020, the big lie that Donald Trump won, and his daughter-in-law. And immediately they began to clean house. They cut staff in the political and data department, a lot of senior positions. Of course, they're going to keep up the fundraising, and they're going to make sure that a lot of those funds go toward, as they have said, you know, every dollar to the Trump's win in November. Now, some Republicans are wondering, are you going to work as much down a ballot for us? And also, there's always questions on how much money will go to some of his legal problems, because as we know, he has a lot of big lawyer fees.
And as you brought up, both Michael Whatley and Laura Trump are election deniers, and they're going to put a lot of resources now as the head of the Republican National Committee into something into election integrity. They're starting an election integrity division. Two election deniers are starting this. Is that the real goal, to fix elections, or is it to further stir up distrust in our elections? So in case Trump loses, they have that to deal with.
Well, we've already seen a lot of stories come up and be reported on that folks like, you know, Cleta Mitchell, again, the North Carolina attorney who was a big election denier, are putting things in place to sow doubt in the elections, particularly in places, let's face it, with minority votes. They always talk about Detroit, Philadelphia, Atlanta, you know, these mm-hmm. places, so that if it is close, very close, or even if Trump does not win, that there are mechanisms there to put things in place to sow doubt and maybe confusion, as we saw this past year. And you already see a lot of Republican House members saying that if they had been in Mike Pence's place, they would not have certified the election. So yes, these so-called election integrity task force are there to cause some mischief. Let's face it.
Eric.
Yeah, I mean, I know that on the face of it, a lot of people look at this, reasonable people, they know that election fraud is almost non-existent, that it's not a problem, and they might be prone to just sort of shrug their shoulders or ignore these conversations. But I don't think we can overstate how damaging it is that we, in the last 4 years, have inculcated this belief that if I win fair and square, but if I lose, it absolutely must be fraud. And it, you know, it's not just limited to presidential races, and it does cut to the heart of our entire political system. This is such a serious problem.
And I'd like to say, personally, my mom was a poll election worker in Maryland, a Republican, actually, and she had such integrity on election day, making sure there was a Republican and a Democrat. And you know, these folks, hardworking poll workers, they do not deserve to be attacked, as we saw, to be maligned. This is, as Eric says, dangerous, and it can be personal because people's lives can be turned upside down, as we saw with Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman.
It's dangerous, and it's undemocratic, and it's un-American. North Carolina Republican-controlled legislature handed a kind of an interesting court case this week, or a reversal of a decision they made. They've been working diligently to weaken the office of the governor, not with regard just to Roy Cooper, but the office itself, by taking powers away. And one of the powers they recently took away was the appointment of elections officials. At the moment, the governor's office, whoever the governor is, there's an extra seat from that governor's party on the elections board. So right now it would be weighted Democratic, but they made it 50-50. And that raised all kinds of red flags because there's worries about how do you break a tie when it's 50-50. Well, the state Supreme Court, which is Superior Court, rather, which was two Republican judges and a Democratic judge, overturned that this week. Eric, how surprising was that?
It's pretty surprising, although, you know, what they said was, you just pointed to one of the huge problems, you know, you can't have a tie over and over again. They said that this law is simply unconstitutional. We have seen, as you mentioned, this has gone on certainly throughout Cooper's two terms as the Republican majority legislature has chipped away at the power of the governor. And by the way, North Carolina governors don't have a lot of power to begin with.
Right.
The instant speculation, of course, is will this be appealed to the state Supreme Court, which flipped to a Republican majority? And if it is, then people wonder, does that mean it's going to live, so to speak, rather than be set back by this three-judge panel?
Ben.
And the thing is, folks, we know how this plays out. Sooner or later, there'll be a Republican governor and there'll be a Democratic-controlled General Assembly, and they're going to regret. It sort of like goes to redistricting. It's like, it's so short-sighted, whether you're Democrat or Republican, it's so short-sighted in that, you know, once the situation flips, it's not going to be conducive to how you want to run government.
What made this unconstitutional? Because the legislature has been taking steps in various different areas to weaken the office of the governor by taking appointment powers and other powers away from the governor, whoever the governor is. What made this unconstitutional?
Well, they summarized in their decision, they called the law, quote, the most stark and blatant removal of appointment power from the governor. So I
since
think that's
a previous
getting,
attempt 6 years ago.
Yes, since a previous sentence. Attempt. So yeah. I think that's getting at how they view this as unconstitutional.
And, okay. You know, the question in itself is telling that this shouldn't be surprising. The fact that judges ruled on the law instead of on political party affiliation, that kind of used to be, of course, and now it kind of is noteworthy.
Tell that to the Supreme Court. I'm sorry.
And that calls into question what would happen. That calls into question what would happen if this is appealed by the legislature to the state Supreme Court, which has a Republican a majority on it. And they've already reversed some decisions of the previous Democratic Supreme Court.
Including the gerrymandering. So, yeah.
As in other Republican-controlled southern states, our legislature passed a Parents' Bill of Rights recently. But this week, we experienced what was probably an unexpected consequence of that. The chair of the Mecklenburg County Domestic Violence Advisory Board says this new law is affecting students' ability to learn about domestic violence. And how so?
So the law has 12 pages of requirements, and among them is that you have to have permission to take part in a number of things, including reproductive health classes, which this outside group, Love Speaks Out, was doing domestic violence, basically about teenage dating violence, and pretty important topic for teenagers. And they were coming into Charlotte Mecklenburg schools and doing this as part of the reproductive health classes. And we discussed this several weeks ago. I did a story saying they are having very low opt-in. What CMS did in response to this law was say, we used to say you had to send in a slip if you don't want your child to participate. Now you have to send in written permission, online permission, if you do want your child to participate or opt-in. The twist to this is it's not 100% clear that CMS interpreted that law right, because there are surveys where the law very explicitly says this must be opt-in. And when it comes to reproductive health, it says parents have the right to consent or withhold consent. And CMS jumped out very early and did their policies. I think it was certainly their good faith interpretation of that law. But since then, the Department of Public Instruction and the North Carolina School Boards Association have said, you know what, actually, opt out is allowable for reproductive health. So I think it's going to be interesting to see if CMS reverses their policy, because whether it's opt in or whether it's opt out, most parents don't respond. Huge numbers don't respond.
This was a criticism of the law on all of these laws. They are so vague, and school boards and counties are so afraid of stepping over the line that they sometimes overinterpret. Maybe, you know, they're overly careful. They self-censor, and you end up having people make policies that in the end might be harmful. And in this case, you know, we see the studies that young people really need instruction, and young women in particular, when you're dating, to know what behaviors are dangerous or maybe warning signs. So in this case, maybe these kids are not getting information that most parents would say, yeah, I want my kid to get this information. But this, you could see this in the beginning when you saw the law. I mean, Governor Cooper did veto it, and his veto was overridden.
So there's this organization, Ann, called Love Speaks Out. They evidently hold these classes about domestic violence, and they canceled or postponed, I think, 53 sessions. And the idea is that parents have to now opt in. And as you said, the rate of opting in is very low. Do we know why it's low? Is it because parents aren't paying attention, or because they really don't want their kids to be part of this? Do we understand what's going on?
We don't know, but again, response rates are always low. And there is one argument that this just shows that all these people really didn't want their kids participating, but I think that's questionable. And I think now that the inbox, it is an online thing, which in and of itself raises the question of, you know, does everybody have that great access? If your primary language is not English and you're a parent and you get something saying you need to come click this button. And CMS has been talking about trying to streamline that process and make it easier, but the inbox is now the equivalent of your kid's book bag, which may or may not have a piece of paper stuffed in the bottom of it that you don't see until it's too late. It's safe to say a lot of them just didn't get to it.
In all of our discussions following Super Tuesday about the primary election and the results, one race I don't believe we ever discussed, and we're going to talk about it briefly today. It's the race for labor commissioner. That's why we didn't discuss it. But what makes this race significant are a couple of things. One is that former Charlotte City Councilman Braxton Winston is the Democratic candidate. He ran unopposed in the Democratic primary and will now face Republican candidate Luke Farley in November. These guys are pretty far apart when it comes to their political point of view and would take a very different approach should one or the other get the job. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that, for example, this week, the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce came out and expressed misgivings about not only Luke Farley, but the winner of the public instruction primary on the Republican side, Michelle Morrow, and said that, quote, these are far-right candidates whose two, I'm sorry, he's a far-right candidate whose two main campaign platform items were banning vaccine requirements for employees and making elevators great again. And it's... It's interesting that
and Mara wants to make academics great again.
Well, we should point out that he has the endorsement of the elevator lady, Cherry Berry, whose picture was in the elevator for 125 years since Otis invented them.
Which is the only thing any of us know about the Department of Labor. But it is interesting that a business organization would come out and say they are concerned about a candidate being too extreme if elected. And in this case, they're pointing to two of the candidates near the top of the ticket on the Republican side. And they also said that about far left candidates. They have the same belief. But you're right, Mike. I mean, we usually don't spend a lot of time on the Labor Department race, Labor Secretary race.
One of the things that Farley has said is that he wants to make the department a secret weapon for economic development, and yet the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce has come out against him. That's odd to me.
Well, it's secret, see, so they don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, and they're basically saying that extremists on either side are bad for business, that you're going to have people are going to be less attractive.
And you know, North Carolina knows that better than most. I'm sorry, Mary. Go ahead.
No, North Carolina is supposed to be a purple state. But if you look now at all the folks at the top of the ticket in every category, both state and federal, from Trump, you know, to Mark Robinson, who I wrote a national column about for Roll Call, to, you know, Dan Bishop and the folks at Public Instruction and Labor, we have a pretty MAGA ballot coming up in North Carolina. So folks will have a choice.
So Braxton Winston advocates for fair pay, adequate Labor Department staffing. He says the needs of businesses and those of the worker are not mutually exclusive. All we know about Farley, that I know about Farley, is that he opposed vaccine requirements for employees and he has the endorsement of the elevator lady. Well, what else in 20 seconds or less?
I think that's the sum of my knowledge as well.
Okay. All right. When we come back, sports gambling has begun. Please, no wagering during this program. It's forbidden. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the MAGA head of the tickets here in North Carolina on various different races at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The local news roundup with Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, Eric Spanberg, Charlotte's Business Journal managing editor, and Ben Thompson, anchor and host of WCNC-TV's Flashpoint. Sports gambling got its official legal start on Monday. Woohoo! You probably know that because leading up to day one, you could not have missed the TV commercials.
FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook, is headed to North Carolina.
Oh yeah, I'm feeling it. FanDuel in North Carolina? Fun is about to begin, everybody.
Hey guys, ESPN Bet is here. Finally, a sportsbook from your favorite sports brand.
Sports betting is coming to North Carolina on March 11th, but you won't want to wait until then to register on Bet365.
Oh, it's about to be a party in here. BetMGM's got all the sports betting in one place, and it's live, baby.
If you only listen to public radio, that's why. And what a start. According to the Charlotte Ledger, the first sporting event North Carolinians could bet on when the app started working at noon on Monday was a European table tennis match. How many of you placed your bets on that one, huh?
Eric, the whole house.
Yeah, the various sporting betting apps enlisted celebrities to hawk their wares and their attributes, and former Carolina Panthers linebacker, the beloved Luke Kuechly, was on the job for FanDuel. He told the Business Journal why. So, why?
Says that this just makes it more fun for the fans so they can enjoy the games and have a bigger interest in what's going on. It's interesting, Mike. Stephen A. Smith from ESPN will be in Charlotte tonight for a watch party of the ACC tournament on behalf of ESPN Bet. So, yeah, you're right. Everybody's bringing someone in or hiring a celebrity to make the pitch.
So most of these apps, and there's several of these betting apps, have tools to monitor your behavior, I guess, to save yourself from yourself, and also how much you're spending. They're monitoring that for you as well. But there have been concerns prior to the launch of this app or these apps, just as there was prior to the launch of the education lottery, that this would result in a rise in the incidence of people with gambling addictions. Ben, you spoke with the woman in charge of the state's gambling addiction program just a couple of days ago. What did she have to say?
Yeah, it's interesting. You've got this real dichotomy of so many people excited, but then you have a whole other group of people of mental health, you know, professionals who have some real concerns here, because, you know, gambling comes with that hit of dopamine and feel good chemicals. And they're especially worried about younger men across the state of North Carolina. So they've gone into, the folks over at DHHS and Raleigh, they've gone into high schools and colleges to make sure people understand the addictive behavior of some of these things for some people, and recognizing the warning signs and that sort of thing. So that while this is a celebratory thing for a lot of folks, it could be a serious problem. And you know what? Gambling addiction, it could happen to anyone.
Do we know how many people have signed up so far? Do we have any idea?
We do. We our friends at BetNC.com, which is Mike Collins' favorite site, bookmarked. Over the first 2 days of online sports betting in North Carolina, 370,000 accounts were set up.
Wow. Okay. All right. Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson is running on the Republican ticket to be, obviously, the state's next governor. He's well known in our state for making outrageous, often offensive statements on topics ranging from homosexuality and condemnation of LGBTQ folks, to spouting anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, mocking school shooting victims. He called them spoiled bastards, his words. He's spoken about all the freedoms lost during the civil rights movement. He has called the Holocaust hogwash. These comments are now beginning to get national attention. But just this weekend, he spoke at an event in Florida in which he said, essentially, the time had come to stand up to the FBI when they come knocking at your door. Not sure why he made those comments, but I saw them on television yesterday. We should pay attention, I suppose, but what difference does it make if the rest of the country is paying attention? Mary, they don't vote for the governor of North Carolina.
No, they don't. But as I said, it's a trend. I think there was a sense that North Carolina, particularly with a Democratic governor, our history of it, was more of a purple state. The fact that Trump won it, but it was his slimmest margin. But I think people are looking at him and saying, Republicans in North Carolina had choices. Conservative choices. Tom Tillis, the senator, endorsed someone else, Mr. Graham, Bill Graham, and they chose Mark Robinson. So what is going on? Do they not know? And as I said in my roll call column, if from the beach to the Blue Ridge Mountains, you know him. He speaks at that decibel level. But do they co-sign it? And what is going on here? And as we've talked about, we have a very conservative top of the ticket. And I think, though, Democrats were kind of hoping they would get Robinson, thinking North Carolina is not that extreme and Josh Stein will have a better chance against him than another candidate. The fact that Democrats have a problem with turnout and the fact that 2/3 of Republican primary voters thought that he was the guy, the fact that Trump has embraced him, and Trump is the strong man head of the party who says he will be a dictator on day one. What does this say about not just North Carolinians, but the country? And that's why I think the country is standing up and taking notice. And also internationally, we have seen stories on him on every network, everything.
Eric.
I was just going to say, you know, Mike, you said the rest of the country doesn't vote for governor, but they do have money and they can pump money in either for Robinson or Stein. And that's something to watch as this becomes more of a national focus.
So go ahead, Ben.
I also see a challenge in how we, I mean, all of us, how we cover him, because critics will say that we're being unfair or that we're mischaracterizing what he said. But the posts are out there, and I would push back and say, we're not claiming Phil Berger said anything like this or Tim Moore or Tom Tillis. This is very specific to one individual and posts that he's made countless times over the last several years.
Yeah, there's tapes exist. People have to understand this. This is not the 1850s. There are
tapes
of this.
And he's trying to pivot now, and it's going to be impossible for him to do that.
So he's raising eyebrows nationally. Someone who should definitely raise eyebrows is the woman who defeated the Republican incumbent for the North Carolina Secretary of Education. Catherine Truitt lost to Michelle Morrow on Super Tuesday. Morrow has tweeted out QAnon conspiracy theories. She has called for death to traitors, including Democrats. And she's called for the death of President Barack Obama. She homeschools her children, yet she wants to be the Secretary of Education. She says she wants to make academics great again, end the woke nonsense, and take back our schools. If she wins, Anne, she'd be in charge of an $11 billion budget. What else do we know about her?
Well, you know, I think in Mecklenburg County, we were not that aware of her. And I will admit, I probably succumbed to Mecklenburg myopia in that, you know, I had anticipated that it would be a Truitt versus Mo Green race. And Mo Green, of course, is the runaway Democratic nominee, easily defeated his opponents with more spending and more endorsements. Catherine Truitt also had big endorsements. Hugh McCall here in Charlotte, Anna Spangler Nelson had a lot of current and former legislators, had far more money. But if you were coming out to vote for Donald Trump and Mark Robinson, you correctly assumed that Michelle Morrow was closer to your viewpoint. So Truitt won in Mecklenburg County, but Michelle Morrow won in across the state and in several of our surrounding counties where she had endorsements from some local school board members who aren't maybe as well known throughout the region, but are very well known in their areas as very conservative.
As Mary mentioned, Mark Robinson is trying to back out of some of the comments that he made previously. Is she, Anne, is she trying to back out of some of the comments that she has made?
I have not succeeded in reaching her yet. I just heard back from her campaign person, who is Sloan Ratchmuth, who is very well known as pretty far down that MAGA road also.
Okay.
And I would
the legislature expanded opportunity scholarships recently. Those are vouchers to help all children attend private schools should they choose to do so. And evidently it's hit a bit of a snag. The program is a hit. There's been a surge of applications. So what's the downside? What's the snag, Ann?
Well, despite dramatic increases in funding, the changes that they made everybody eligible, regardless of income, and you no longer have to be coming in from a public school. If you've had your kids in private school for 5 years and now you want the voucher, you're eligible. So they got 72,000 applications, which is way more than they've ever gotten. And about half of those were from people who wouldn't have been eligible by income before, people making more than $115,000 a year for a family of four. And now what happens, and it's still very squishy, we don't know for sure how this will play out. There's a lot of variables, but they may have to say, and they set up the priorities that lower income gets top priority. So they may now have to say to some of those higher income families, sorry, the money ran out, you don't get it, which is setting up something that we're going to see almost certainly in the General Assembly, which is a battle over whether they should freeze or expand funding.
We had CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill on this program yesterday, and we touched on a number of topics, including those vouchers. But we also spoke about the impact charter schools are having on public education and on CMS. She is the first and, to my knowledge, the only CMS superintendent not to give a wholehearted endorsement to charter schools.
Currently, we spend of county dollars, $100 million a year goes to charter schools. Charter schools that are left unchecked in terms of accountability. They are unchecked in terms of the requirements that we have to have from anything from the buildings that we have our students in all the way to certification for teachers, providing transportation, school nutrition, all of those things that are requirements for the public school system are not the same requirements for charter schools and, of course, not for private schools.
So she stressed the playing field is terribly unlevel, and she was all too willing to shed some light on what happens when things at charter schools go wrong.
Well, guess who gets the call that has to go clean up the charter school's mess? We do. And we get that notice with, you have 5 days, 5 business days to get your finance team, your building services team. We need you to go over there. We need you to assess their assets. You need to assign value to them. You need to determine if you're going to collect any student records in 5 days.
I've had every single school superintendent since charter schools became a thing on this program. I've asked every single one of them about charter schools, and they've already always painted a sunny, we're all for charter schools kind of picture. She didn't do it. It's the first time ever. What should we make of this, Anne?
Well, I don't know. Nobody loves having to hand off some of the money to charter schools, and we have seen ever-increasing enrollment in charter schools, which means ever-increasing money going to the charter schools. But she was more heavy on the unequal. A lot of them have talked about, oh, we can be partners, we can learn from them. I think there have not been a lot of cases of charter schools doing something that then extrapolates statewide. The five-day thing was new to me, and I'm still trying to clear that up. The state law does say that assets go to the district if a school closes, which is great. I don't know why they have to do it in 5 days.
And Dr. Hill also made big changes to the administration of the schools this week. She said that the current structure puts too much responsibility on the officials who oversee schools in 9 geographic learning communities.
Some of our learning communities are the size of some of our neighboring districts, but not having the resources available to that learning community superintendent to appropriately serve.
So she named 10 superintendents. How will this work?
Well, they will be now, instead of divided up by geography, they will be divided up by grade level. So you'll have some who are in charge of a group of elementary schools, different middle, high, one for K-8. And she's saying that will be more effective in serving the schools.
Meanwhile, a group of principals went to Raleigh to ask state lawmakers this week to revise the state's pay plan, which they say ties too much money to growth in test scores and doesn't reward principals for leading the most challenging schools. Ashley Falkenberry is a Craven County Elementary School principal who says pay tiers should factor in such things as how many students are impoverished or homeless, are ESL students, or have disabilities.
More complex schools equals high stress, higher burnout, more turnover, and less stability for schools. So simply put, more complex schools are more difficult to lead.
And principals at bigger schools get higher pay, but according to the State Principals Association, size doesn't tell the whole story. What are they asking for? Quickly.
They are asking for less money to be tied to performance pay, which is these EVOS test score ratings. They are calling for retention bonuses, changes again in the way that you're put into tiers so that these factors of complexity weigh in. And they're saying this will help retain good principals, which is a pretty important thing.
We learned a few months ago that the Wells Fargo tournament would not be renewing its sponsorship of the Wells Fargo golf tournament, a PGA Tour event. You're hearing, Eric, about progress being made on finding a new sponsor for that.
Who are the names that surfaced this week? TIAA and Truist, both large companies, with one headquartered Truist in Charlotte and the other with a large presence here. So we'll see what happens, Mike. They need to get something in place probably by later this year so that they're ready for the future years.
I think it's interesting that one of the things that came out of this is that there was a fear that they were going to move this tournament to another city. But then there are all those people who attend in person, and that's a draw for the PGA, which is interesting because I thought all the money came from television. Speaking of television, Ben Thompson is here. We know that the home prices and mortgage interest rates are high all over the country, and certainly here in Charlotte. It's pricing a lot of people out of homes. And this week, Zillow reported on the income needed to afford a mortgage in Charlotte. What did they reveal, Ben?
They found that you have to make $111,000 to afford a home in Charlotte. That's alarming when you compare it to the number just 4 years ago, and that number went up $55,000 in 4 years. Charlotte almost unparalleled in how much more expensive it's gotten in the last few years. It's a stunning set of numbers that's surprising to a lot of folks, but probably not surprising to a lot of others.
And we're still one of the fastest growing regions in the country, so that will not be abated, no doubt. Very quickly, because we're almost out of time, I have less than 30 seconds. Country music star Luke Combs, quoted this week as asking, "What are we doing?" He's a Panthers fan, something he describes as slow torture. So what are we doing to provoke that outburst?
We traded Brian Burns. for a second and a fifth round draft pick. We always trade these great stars like Christian McCaffrey and don't get great stuff for them. Even Luke Combs is frustrated.
And with that, we must stop. Mary C. Curtis finally gets the chance to talk about sports. From RollCall.com, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, and Doss Helms from WFAE, and Ben Thompson from WCNC.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.